Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Supreme Court's latest limits on affirmative action have sent fresh ripples through the debate over race-based college admissions. Remember 2 weeks ago, the court ruled that states can ban affirmative action from their state universities based on a referendum? Most racial justice advocates were outraged. But my next guest, Georgetown law professor Cheryl Cashin, a well-known critic of the effects of 21st century segregation, takes a different view. The title of her new book hints at why. It's called Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Professor Cashin, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me back.
And let's begin at the end of your book. It's a letter to your own six-year-old twin boys, Langston and Logan, who you admit you might be hurting in a way with the stand that you take. Will you start there?
Well, yes. I mean, I have written a book that limits the possibility if universities followed my suggestions that they will ever benefit from race-based affirmative action or legacy preferences. I mean, their father went to Harvard College, their mother went to Vanderbilt. But what I'm saying is, you know, my kids are so advantaged. Some days I can barely stand them. Frankly, you know, I love them to death, but they have every advantage. Every cognitive need has been taken care of. They're in an incredible, well-resourced, very diverse Mandarin Immersion International Baccalaureate School. They have two different tutors, everything they need, and they have parents who are there reading to them, doing everything with, you know, the parents have 6 degrees between them, and they will be fine. And if they're not fine, that's because they didn't choose to take it, you know, to exploit or you know, do as much as they did with all this advantage. I was raised to care about other people's kids. I love mine. I'm doing being a good mom, but there are millions of children out there in separate and equal schools. The vast majority of Black and Latino kids in this country are in separate and unequal, under-resourced schools. And the irony for progressives who are fighting to support race-based affirmative action is this policy, as practiced, particularly in elite higher education, does very little to help kids who are in separate and unequal schools. And I'm arguing that the strivers who do everything they can, who work very hard and take the most challenging classes available to them, they're the kids, and regardless of their color, they're the kids who need and deserve a leg up in admissions processes. And that's where I am. And the other irony about all this, you know, you can go to universities and see optical diversity in the classroom. I'm in this environment myself. And often what you see is optical diversity, but if you go below the surface, a lot of what you're seeing is very advantaged children of all colors, and not much diversity in terms of where people come from and their life backgrounds. And the irony with this is that this policy does fuel resentment. And we're in a bad place in this country in terms of our politics. I think our politics are broken. And I prefer to support strategies that encourage rather than discourage cross-racial alliances, that makes it possible to attack the underlying structures that are creating inequality in K-12 and inequality in American society.
Listeners, should we do affirmative action based on place, not race? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And you're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York and New Jersey Public Radio with my guest, Georgetown University Law Professor Cheryl Cashin, author of a new book called Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. You cite some models out there where place, not race, affirmative action is being done. Want to describe a few?
Yes. Well, first of all, there about 8 states have banned affirmative action based on race, and so universities in those states have had to innovate. And the most well-known innovation are these top 10% plans in California, Texas, Florida, the top in Florida, I think it's the top 20%, but basically the idea is that the top 10% of the people in their high school class have an automatic right to attend flagship universities, the flagship university system in their state. And I'm not saying this is the only strategy, but that policy has dramatically expanded the pipeline. You have people of color and working class white kids from rural districts that were never getting into the University of Texas, now going to the University of Texas, and it has dramatically raised the college-going behavior of students at schools that didn't used to think of themselves as being able to compete to go to UT. So, it's been an enormously successful policy.
So in a New York context, this top 10% would mean if you're in the top 10% at Stuyvesant High School or if you're in the top 10% at a very troubled high school in the South Bronx, you would automatically qualify and equally qualify for admission to if there was an equivalent flagship state university here.
Now there. I can't speak to the niceties of how it's managed. UT has a certain number of slots, but you would have automatic access to some state university, right? And it has raised the college-going behavior. It's also created a strong multiracial, bipartisan coalition that supports that policy in the state.
I want to drill down a little bit on that, because I guess one of the areas that leaves me a little skeptical is your argument that this would quiet the white backlash. If place is really a surrogate for disadvantaged people of color, won't white people see through that and start holding referenda to ban that kind of affirmative action as quasi-racial? You know, they'll say,
right,
my top 11% student in our posh Houston suburb got much higher SAT scores and is much better qualified than the black or Latino top 10%er from downtown Dallas who is admitted under your program. It's a scheme cooked up to give kids of color an advantage. Justice Scalia, here we come. You don't think that will happen?
Right. Well, in Texas, actually, it's white suburban, white parents from highly high-income suburban districts have been the ones who've tried to get that policy repealed, and you've had an unusual coalition, strange bedfellows whites from disadvantaged districts have stood firm to say, no, we support this policy. So I don't completely agree, but let me make it clear. I'm calling not just for consideration of place, giving consideration of the setting from which a high achieving student comes from, but I'm also calling on universities to completely redo their admissions policies and eliminate any practice that reinforces advantage. SAT scores, SAT standardized tests should be optional. Financial aid should go back to being based on solely on need, not merit. Legacy preferences and other kinds of preferences should be eliminated. And the admissions process should be a holistic process in which the admissions officer looks at the factors that truly do predict success in college. And the number one predictor of a kid's success, likely success in college, is their cumulative GPA and their work ethic. The SAT is nowhere to be found. And so I'm talking about reintroducing fairness. And the reason I focus on place is that, increasingly, high-income people and very highly educated people are segregating into their own communities. Only 42% of all Americans today live in a middle-class neighborhood, and that's down from 65% in 1970. And again, that's because of the segregation of the affluent. And if you are able to buy your way into what I call these gold standard neighborhoods, and everybody knows what those neighborhoods are, what those jurisdictions are, you have automatic access to highly selective, well-funded K through 12 education that sets you up really, really well to go into selective higher education. And if you're outside those networks, outside those neighborhoods, you have a much more difficult chance of doing that. And so, I featured in the last chapter of my book, which is called Reconciliation. The book is about affirmative action, but it's also about how do we get to a place where we can have a saner, more cohesive, multiracial politics for fairness. And I feature some of these multiracial coalitions. One of the unifying themes for people is that, I can see the commonality of my struggling older white suburb that's rapidly changing racially and some of these inner city contexts. Increasingly, there's a lot of commonality to the condition in the daily lives of struggling white folks and people of color. And if progressives don't start to be about the business of trying to build those coalitions based on that commonality and pursue strategies that bring people along together, I think we're doomed in this country.
Cheryl Cashin, Georgetown Law Professor. Her new book, Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Are you surprised that our phones are ringing off the hook? Robin.
Here we go.
Robin in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. To a large degree, I agree with your guest. I'm the mother of a biracial daughter who went to Yale and then to law school. Very smart, got into Stuyvesant, so I'm sure she could have gotten to the places she got largely on her own achievement. But there's no question that race was considered in both of those educational situations. I think the advantage of that is that you wind up with a higher education system that is racially diverse, which obviously is in danger at this point. And that in and of itself is a valuable thing. But I certainly think that my middle-class daughter, who went to private school, who had an SAT tutoring experience when she needed it, et cetera, doesn't need the kind of leg up that a kid in Appalachia does, or a kid, in a poor white neighborhood in Brooklyn. And, I think it's really time, despite what I think is the real value of affirmative action based on race, even now, I think it's really time to broaden the horizon on this and take a bigger look at it.
Thank you. So you agree with Cheryl Cashin. Peter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I, to some extent, agree with the last caller, but I'm a little worried about the emphasis on geographic place when I think the real problem is economic class, and that by focusing on the geography of it, what you're going to end up doing is culling the children of professionals who still remain in these depressed neighborhoods. I mean, even in Appalachia, there are committed doctors with children in depressed areas. I know them. I myself came from the south side of Chicago, which at the time I was born was completely a black ghetto, but I was the son of professionals. And so I'm worried about the emphasis on geography, that's going to be manipulated to produce a result where you're again, as with the last caller, culling the children of the professional class when without really drilling down and getting to the need where it exists, which is in these families that have no inherited wealth. That really is the defining thing. Not just the income at the present moment, but no inherited wealth, no accumulated wealth.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, caller. And I say in my book, the chapter where I lay out my proposed reforms, I say that colleges should focus on the structural disadvantages that the applicant has had to
overcome. And one thing I suggest is if they come from a place where more than 20% of the people around them are poor, that has a structural advantage. But the next factor I suggest is low family wealth. I agree with you. I'm not. I want to be clear. You know, place, not race. You have to have a theme to promote a book. But I talk about a range of factors. I'm not saying that place is the only factor to consider. But I do think, given how much place structures access to opportunity in this country, and anybody who just lives in the country knows that, that it should be that admissions officers should pay attention to it. But I say people should be able to, in the application form, submit a statement that explains any kind of disadvantage they've had to overcome, and that place and low family wealth should be a factor that gets extra weight.
Can't they already do that? Can't on any college application any student describe the kind of disadvantage that they have in addition to checking off the box, you know, that asks them for their race?
They can, but what I'm saying here, and, you know, again, I know this is not popular with my civil rights community, but there is this irony where being able to consider race enables universities to achieve this optical diversity kind of on the cheap. You know, you don't have to really get at the serious structural systems that cause exclusion in this country. And frankly, a lot of the kids that benefit from having black skin, this is going to get me in trouble, but are black immigrants, people of West Indian and African descent who don't come out of this history of slavery or Jim Crow, or and on average don't live this segregated existence. What tends to happen is, and also because of the influence of U.S. News and World Report, elite higher education gets its optical diversity the easiest way it can, with the least amount of resistance and the least amount of cost, and it doesn't upset these pervasive structures of disadvantage in our society.
Jim in South Orange, you're on WNYC with Cheryl, with our guest Cheryl Cashin. Hi.
Good morning. How you doing?
Okay.
I'm a multi-ethnic. I have a varied background, which I guess makes me a typical American today. I'm Cuban, Russian, Canary Islander. I consider myself a global citizen. That being said, I would never want to minimize the experience, the injustice that African-Americans have been through. However, for a very long time, I have been in total agreement with what the author is saying. I think that getting past race in our attempts to address the class-based struggle that we are dealing with increasingly, it has just gotten so extreme. We hear things like the fact that the minimum wage today should be $35 in 1960 when you look at what the minimum wage was in 1960. That struggle overarches everything. And again, I don't want to minimize the race-based injustice that has gone on for centuries in this country. But
All right, I understand. Jim, I get it, and I'm going to move on, very much agreeing with our guest. And Cheryl Cashin, let me ask you specifically about the latest Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action, allowing states to ban it for their state university systems based on a referendum. And I gather you supported that. I saw you.
I want to be clear. I didn't necessarily support the decision. I wasn't surprised by it. I'm not this, neoconservative out here saying I'm against affirmative action, but I'm dealing with the real politic of we have five members on the court that are not – four members outright want to ban the policy and say it's unconstitutional. Justice Kennedy is skeptical about it,
And that's the reality we're in. I think affirmative action, race-based affirmative action, is on life support. And this recent opinion is basically saying it's up to politics if states want to ban it. And this is really easy politics for Republicans in red states. And so I suspect you will see some more of these bans. And so for those who care about diversity, I mean, the good news is that most institutions, I think, continue to feel an imperative to try to be diverse, and that's not going to change. The question is the means. What means are politically doable, legal, and fair?
Kathleen,
and actually help.
Kathleen and Little Silver, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Okay.
I hope to say that I agree with what you're saying entirely. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia, and I was the first in my family to go to college. And I think college at the time cost more than my father was making, or pretty close to it. But now I live in an affluent suburb in New Jersey, and I'm going through the college process for my daughter. And she just doesn't need those advantages. You know, we've done what we can, and I think that it should be a combination of economics and place. I totally agree. Because I think then you will get a deeper diversity, as you're saying.
Yeah, so when you look in polling, where your caller is, I think, is where most people are. In polling, when asked if you would support consideration of race as a factor in admissions, the majority of people, particularly white people, disagree with that. But most people of all races think it would be fair to give a hardworking kid who comes from a disadvantaged school, disadvantaged setting. And by the way, some kids are competing. You may be the valedictorian of a inner city high school and work extremely hard. You're competing with some kids at schools that have 20 AP classes, and you may have had only two available to you. But most people in polls feel like that's fair. That makes sense to me.
Kathleen, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And we will leave it there with Cheryl Cashin. And interestingly, that as represented by most of the callers who you spoke to, we have so many African-American callers chiming in to agree with you on the board. I guess that's by the luck of the draw in a thoroughly unscientific sample who happened to call in. But you are getting a lot of pushback out there.
Please go read the book and see what you think about it.
Cheryl Cashin, Georgetown Law Professor, author now of Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Keep the conversation going at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Professor Cashin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why New Yorkers on Obamacare insurance plans have almost no out-of-plan options for seeing a doctor. Stay with us.